Hi, everybody. Glad you're with us on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Hari Kondabolu is a comedian of Indian descent from Brooklyn who takes on some of the biggest political and social issues of the day, including racism, colonialism, even the color of Jesus.
Why would you need to make white chocolate? Do you love the taste of chocolate, but can't stand looking at it? Well, then try some white chocolate. It's from the people that brought you white Jesus.
The New York Times has called Hari Kondabolu one of the most exciting political comics in stand-up today. You may have caught him on Letterman, Conan, or Jimmy Kimmel. And a week from Sunday, you can catch him live at the Creative Alliance in East Baltimore. This morning, Hari Kondabolu joins me on the line from Seattle. Welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you spend a lot of time in Seattle, I guess. You live in Brooklyn, but you're out in Seattle pretty frequently.
Yeah, it's kind of like ground zero with my jokes. I start there. I started my comedy career here, so I'll still fly back to Seattle like maybe three or four times a year, rent out a 50-seat theater, do four shows in two nights, you know, start with an hour of new stuff, and by the end of it, I'll know what works. But that first show for audience members is very painful. It's me rambling and not knowing where the punchlines are. But I think people like the excitement of that. But, you know, I always end up with a bunch of new material. It's my favorite place to write and create and think freely without the pressures of New York. So it's great. I'm excited for this Baltimore show just because I've written so many new things in Seattle that, like, if people have seen me in D.C., I've never performed in Baltimore before, but if they have seen me in D.C., like, they're going to get a lot of new stuff.
Your road to comedy and your life as a stand-up comedian and writer is an interesting bit of circuitousness. It includes a stop at the London School of Economics for a master's in human rights. You grew up in Queens. I mean, how did you end up doing this? When did you start actually doing stand-up? And how does the London School of Economics fit into your grand master plan?
It definitely, like, this doing stand-up was not part of a grandmaster plan. It's something I stumbled into. I mean, I'll be clear about that. But I was 17. I always loved stand-up, and I started a comedy night in my high school, Townsend Harris High School, called Comedy Night, because I was that creative at that age. And I did my first set there, like 45 minutes of very derivative, stereotypical jokes, a lot of stuff that was also probably copied from Chris Rock and Margaret Cho with the word Indian slipped in. Like, it wasn't like the most creative act, but it was my first time on stage. Went to Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine, and Wesleyan University for a year, and was able to really like develop a lot of my like early stuff there, learn how to perform for 45 minutes, like really perform. But it wasn't something I thought I could do professionally, because I'd go home to New York on breaks and realize, you know what it felt like to get your butt kicked. Like, New York is a hard place to start doing stand-up. So I did it because I enjoyed it. I moved to Seattle to be an immigrant rights organizer. Like, my politics very much were influenced post 9/11. I really wanted to help, you know, the immigrant communities. And like, I've always been a big, you know, advocate for human rights. And this was kind of like, okay, this is where I want my life to go. And there was a really good young comedy scene in Seattle at the time. So I would do comedy at night as a hobby and as relief from a really difficult job working with victims of hate crimes and people who were in immigration detention or their families who were dealing with, you know, their family members being deported or about to be deported, workplace discrimination. There was a lot of difficult stuff, and the nights would be these wonderful places to create. And somehow I got discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival. You know, they saw some clips of mine online. I got these auditions for this festival. I'd never submitted to anything before. I got in. I got booked to be on Jimmy Kimmel Live. I took a day off from work, flew, did the TV show, flew back to work in Seattle the next day, and people were like, were you on TV last night? Like, it was very strange because I had no plans on making this hobby a real thing. Like, it didn't seem like it was in the realm of possibility, especially as a comic who talks about race and gender and sexuality. Like, I talk about the things I'm really, you know, that I really care about that mean a lot to me, and about justice. And I ended up getting into the London School of Economics because they had a human rights master's program I really wanted. And I decided, despite the fact this career had surprisingly shown up, that I wanted to get my master's. So I did. And comedy was waiting for me. Like, I was still able to get on TV and perform in clubs. And people were interested in what I had to offer. And certainly, like, the master's degree wasn't to support the comedy career, you know, though you know, it's kind of funny that a human rights career and a comedy career, they're probably as lucrative, which is not lucrative at all.
Right.
So
yeah, you go for the big bucks either way. Yeah. Right.
Right. Either way, money was wasted. Maybe it wasn't wasted, but it was certainly like I'm not using my degree in any way that LSE expected me to use it, perhaps.
On 81, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, the comedian Hari Kondabolu, he'll be performing at the Creative Alliance here in Baltimore a week from Sunday. You do mind these issues of racism and colonialism and gender and sexuality. These are not inherently funny topics. What do you think the unique capacity of comedy is to enlighten and, you know, expand people's understanding of what can often be very difficult subjects?
Well, you have a buy-in that you don't generally have when you discuss things in public without comedy, and you know, when you have a conversation with somebody. The promise of laughter allows people to expand their attention spans more than they normally would. Certainly, people willing to open their mind because of comedy allows for thoughts to infiltrate that normally wouldn't. Even if you disagree with them, you have to deal with them. You have to deal with, like, I disagree with this person, but I'm laughing. I deal with that inconsistency. Why do I feel that way? And that's something that I think a lot of art forms cannot offer. Also, I think it's amazing because it's just a person in a microphone. You know, it's such a, How in a day where people can't watch more than a minute and a half of a YouTube clip without getting bored, how can human beings be able to watch an hour of a human talking with no production values? I mean, I think there's something beautiful about the fact that people still want to be connected to an individual. They still want to feel, you know, like they can relate and that they're laughing in a group. They still want that. And that allows for the comic to be able to talk about a lot of different things and have people be willing to listen.
Well, I think you're exactly right. And of course, the key to it is that the person in the microphone have to be really compelling. You wrote in the New York Times just last month, I suppose in a way there's nothing more deadly than sort of analyzing comedy and what makes things
right.
Fun.
Yeah.
But this is public radio, so we have to, you know.
Right, sure.
You know, but when you wrote in the Times, you talked about silence and about the courage that it takes to be, you know, sensitive and sort of hip to the silence that you have to let happen when you're doing stand-up. It seems to me a stand-up is such a difficult thing to do and that it's so fraught with train wrecks at every turn.
Yeah, and that's one of the great things about stand-up is there's something, it's like an open mic is the great equalizer. A new joke is the great equalizer. You could be a comic doing it for 20 years. When you have a new joke and you're trying it out, you're in the same position that an open micer is who has written their first joke for the first time, right? Like, you don't know where it's going to go. You're trying to make it funny. And if it doesn't work, you're desperately trying to fix it. Like, you're in the same place. I mean, how that joke develops and the skills you have are different, but at least going up there with nerves about a new idea, you know, that's the same thing. I find that really beautiful and compelling.
Yeah. I mean, are things different now at this point in your career? Number one, you've, you know, progressed and just become much more well-known and in front of the public. And also, you know, people of Asian Pacific descent have also a lot more Asian Pacific comics and actors are on the scene. I just wonder what's different now than when you were starting, you know, back in your college days.
I mean, there's definitely a change in climate. I mean, part of the reason why I never thought this could be a career is because I didn't have any role models. You know, I loved Margaret Cho, but she stood out. Like, there weren't many people like Margaret Cho who, like, were Asian American and saying their truth and talking about their families. I mean, that was groundbreaking to me. That's the reason I wanted to do stand-up. She was the reason. But there weren't that many examples, and I didn't see any South Asians not playing stereotypical parts on television and film, and I didn't really see that many models, especially with stand-up. There, other than Russell Peters, who was, you know, Canadian, no one in America that really showed me it was a feasible thing. But now you watch TV, and you see South Asian anchors, you see actors, you see comedians. You know that you're not alone. There's been a sea change, and I feel it. I mean, that certainly gives me more confidence, first of all. And also, I remember going on stage, even in those early days in Seattle, a very progressive city. And you could sense audiences being confused that I wasn't addressing race early. Why aren't you addressing the fact you're Indian? How come you sound this way? What are you talking? Like, I didn't fit whatever perception they had of Indian people or Indian Americans. And you know,
yeah,
I'm
it's an a priori assumption that you're going to talk about that because that's all
right
they've
off the
ever
bat.
Heard anybody talk about. Yeah,
right. You know, or the fact that I'm political. Maybe my influences are people like Paul Mooney and Pryor and Rock, who have a strong voice and who can show rage on stage and still be funny. Like, that's not what they expected. And I think now, I mean, it's still not universal, but now there's more examples of South Asians in the media. So I think the novelty of seeing me just as a figure on stage has not completely disappeared, but it's certainly dissipated. So you can see me, and your first shock is your first thought isn't like, what is this? People at least will be like, oh yeah, this is a South Asian person. That's interesting. I wonder what he has to say versus like, this is weird. What is he doing up there? You know, and that's a major change. That's a huge change. And I feel more comfortable getting on stage and saying whatever I want. Part of that is also confidence. I've been doing this for 15 years, but also knowing that like there's less of a freak show element and that there's a lot of people who are going to see me in particular because they've seen my work on the internet, because they've seen me on television. So there's a confidence in knowing there's going to be some people at least that like know what they're getting themselves into.
Sure. I'm interested that guys like Jerry Seinfeld, among others, who's of course older, he's white, he's been in the business a long, long time, but he's complained that audiences in a way are becoming too politically correct. He says it's harder now for comedians to make jokes because people are, you know, sort of more conscious about what's considered offensive. What's your take on that perspective?
I think that makes him sound ancient. I mean, if you, like that, even when people say things are politically correct, I mean, people have rationale and reasons why they feel the way they feel. It dismisses what those reasons are. Like, progress is never easy, and we're living in a time where there's so much progress very quickly, you know, whether it's the gay rights movement, the transgender movement, what we've seen with Black Lives Matter. You know, there was a time in this country when you could say whatever you wanted to say, right? And anything went. And part of the reason for that is because a lot of people of color and queer folks and women were excluded, right? They didn't have a chance to have their voice heard. They weren't in the workplace. You can make whatever off-color jokes you wanted. You could say whatever you wanted because there was no one to disagree. There was no one to influence the conversation in any other way, or at least no one with power. And now all of a sudden you have people seeping into the media who are people of color, who are queer folks. The internet allows for a certain equality that wasn't there before. So it's changed. So the exciting thing is, how do you address a different situation? Like, your responsibility as a comic is to address what's happening in society, what's happening in a room, to notice the sea change that is happening in society, you know, within society. Like, if by saying things are politically correct, what you're doing is you're dismissing what's in front of you. You're not addressing what's in front of you. You're just using a term to just like pretend it's not there. I think offense is an easy word. Sometimes it's not offense. People are logical in that I disagree with this. I think that's wrong. I'm not offended by it. I know why I think it's wrong. Do you know what I mean? When I hear a racist joke, I'm not offended. I'm like, that's racist.
Yeah.
That's wrong. That's a wrong thing. That is incorrect. That information is wrong. You're spreading lies. It's incorrect. And the incorrectness of it, not the politically incorrect, the actual incorrectness of the statement is too strong for me to forgive it in order to laugh. You know, that's part of it. So I think that it fundamentally ignores your job as a comedian to say things are politically correct and then just dismiss an audience. So your job is to figure it out. I have to figure it out. Everybody has to figure out what's happening in a crowd at a particular time.
And for those crowds, I think the term of art that comedians use is punching up. You tend to punch up, making jokes about people sort of at the top of the rung of, you know, power and celebrity and notoriety, rather than, you know, mock the people on the lower rungs. That's a conscious decision. That's a conscious approach.
Yeah, I mean, that's who I am. You know, like I, the same thing I think I suppose that drew me to immigrant rights organizing. You know, when I was in my early 20s, it's the same values. Like, I go after the people I feel like are doing the oppressing or who have privilege. You know, that's where the harder targets are. Do you know what I mean? You're making fun of homeless people. I've heard enough jokes about homeless people. I've heard enough jokes about minorities. You know, it's not to say that I'm punching up because it's a new creative angle. I'm doing it because it's like what I feel. And also as an artist, it is more challenging, to be perfectly honest. Like, it's harder to hit angles and make people uncomfortable. And if you can play with discomfort and still make people laugh, I mean, the laughs are, to me, even more valuable. It's like, I was able to bring you to a place you did not want to go, and yet you still laughed at the end. I think that's an accomplishment. And to me, that's in addition to what I think is just, I also think that's a bigger artistic achievement.
Comedian Hari Kondabolu will do two shows at the Creative Alliance a week from Sunday, August 23rd. The 7 o'clock show is sold out. There are still tickets remaining for the 9:30 show, but the folks at Creative Alliance tell us they're going fast. Hari Kondabolu will be joined on that bill by Liz Mealy and local comedian Umar Khan. His debut stand-up album is called Waiting for 2042. We've got links to more information on our website. Come on over to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. Stay with us.